one guy. He's a miner. I mean, holy moly, you know, he might have lost $1 million worth of equipment and his house.
Eagle residents cope with the flooding disaster. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 6th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congress discusses how to address the consequences of global warming.
The Arctic sea ice is melting far more rapidly than policy is able to keep up with it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and a sustainable salmon population in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/Copper River.
Governor Palin has issued a disaster declaration for interior communities hit by flooding. State Department of Emergency Services spokesman Jeremy Zedek says the declaration facilitates coordination between agencies and eases access to disaster assistance funding.
State has public assistance and individual assistance. Public assistance helps repair infrastructure, damaged roads, damaged utilities, things of that nature, other critical infrastructure. Individual assistance is to provide temporary housing to people and then possibly grant funds so they can rebuild their homes.
Zedek says the declaration could also lead to federal disaster relief funds. He says assistance will be available regardless of insurance coverage. Many residents of flood-prone areas can't get flood insurance. Zedek says the state is ramping up its response at Eagle, the area hardest hit by flooding so far. A multi-agency incident management team has been deployed to the Yukon River community where record high water and abnormally thick ice have destroyed or damaged at least 30 structures and displaced as many as 60 people from the city to nearby native village sites and remote homesteads. As of earlier today, water levels remained high as ice continued to clog a several-mile stretch of the Yukon. Eagle Assistant Mayor Bo Fay says area residents are waiting on the river.
Basically, everybody's just on hold because of the water's at an impasse. You know, I mean, it went up to the it didn't go as high as it did the night before. But, I mean, a lot of people, they don't have houses anymore. And there's a few that don't have houses or vehicles anymore. And one guy, he's a miner. I mean, holy moly, you know, he might have lost $1 million worth of equipment and his house.
Fay says numerous fuel spills have caused widespread pollution in the flooded parts of the community.
Any of the fuel that was out there, you know, ended up on top of the water. And so it's basically, you know, there's a fuel smell all over all of downtown.
Fay ticks off a list of public projects the city has requested help with, including repairs to water and sewer, power and telephone, roads, and the city's retaining wall. He says the area's worst flood in recorded history will change Eagle forever. He says many residents may decide not to stay.
There's some of these guys that they got no intention of ever rebuilding. I mean, would you rebuild somewhere if there was 30 feet of water where your house was, you know?
Fay says right now the community is busy taking care of displaced residents and restoring transportation, communications, and power to the nearby Native village. Supplies and support from a range of government agencies, Native organizations, and charities are starting to make their way in by air and over the Taylor Highway, which the state has been working to keep open. Many people are staying at the Eagle School, which is also providing meals. Principal Ann Millard says donations of food and clothing are arriving, but there are two particular items still needed.
Dog food and cat food so that people can feed their pets. Things like rubber boots. We could use different sizes of rubber boots.
Millard says she's hesitant to ask for too much because they've already placed a number of requests and they want to see what arrives before seeking additional help. Millard says there's still the lingering concern that another push of meltwater may come down the Yukon and cause additional flooding and devastation. Anchorage residents that wish to help out with relief efforts for Eagle residents can drop off donations of clothing, rubber boots, and other supplies to the Cook Inlet Tribal Council office. The effort is being spearheaded by former Eagle resident and current Anchorage station KNBA music host Cheyenne Beatty and musician Mr. White Keys, who for many years offered satirical Alaskan comedy from the Fly-By Night Club in Anchorage. White Keys says the Eagle community is a special place.
It's this just incredible example of Alaskan history. It's just one of the coolest towns in Alaska. And, you know, gee, I just saw that all this stuff was happening up there and decided that, you know, we should give these guys all the help we can get.
White Key says they've already had a load of flashlights dropped off and volunteers have offered to truck supplies to Eagle. He says residents are sharing what they have, including towels and bedding.
But of course, then those guys are down to half of their normal supply of bedding and pillows and towels. So, you know, we're sort of trying to help out the whole community.
White Key says although there has been talk of organizing volunteers to help with the eventual cleanup effort, that's a ways off.
There are these huge chunks of ice that have washed up into the town around the buildings, and some of the buildings, they can't even see what has happened to the building because they can't get through the ice jam that's around it.
The Cook Inlet Tribal Council office is on San Geronimo Drive, across from the Anchorage Daily News. Breakup on the Kuskokwim River is now sending floodwaters into the village of Kalskag. It's the latest village to be threatened by floodwaters along the river. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
Several mid-river villages have already experienced damaging floodwaters. Now that breakup is moving downriver, Kalskag is on high alert. Ben Bach is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service. He has been doing aerial surveys of the Kuskokwim.
There's a little jam on the lower end of Kalskag that's causing water backup. It's not much of a jam. It's just a little jam. But the water levels are high enough already that it won't take much for villages down here in the lower Kuskokwim to get some flooding.
Currently, the water has come up over the road connecting lower and upper Kalskag. If the ice jam does not release, water levels could continue to rise there. Further downriver in Kuithluk, water is continuing to surround the village, but it has not yet overtaken any roads or buildings. James Nikorai is a Kuithluk resident. He says people there are getting ready for the worst.
The people are putting their stuff away, like the snow machines and the other usable stuff. They're putting them on higher level, high ground. And the offices are putting their stuff off the floor, preparing for high water.
The National Weather Service is recommending that all villages on the lower Kuskokwim have a flood plan in place. Further downriver, the ice near the Bethel area is developing open holes but is still strong in many areas. That is raising concerns that ice jams could continue to develop over the course of breakup. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The Arctic is changing rapidly, and the United States needs to catch up with other nations to cope and influence the future of the far north. That's the opinion of experts who gathered in Washington yesterday for a roundtable discussion on the global implications of a warming Arctic. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, their concerns ranged from environmental to geopolitical.
Melting sea ice is creating new passages through the Arctic, opening up potential for commerce, tourism, and natural resource development. It's changing the map at the top of the world and will likely change the day-to-day experiences of the people and wildlife who live there, according to experts who spoke at Tuesday's roundtable discussion. So Senator John Kerry, who chairs the Foreign Relations Committee, wanted to hear them talk about their biggest concerns.
It's very challenging, but it's also very urgent. And I can sense that. So it's in our interest, in our economic interest, as well as in our national security interest, to get on this fast. So we will do that and use this as the baseline.
Scott Borgerson with the Council on Foreign Relations says new opportunities in the Arctic could lead to cooperation among nations, or they could create a major conflict zone.
The Arctic has all the ingredients, history would tell us, of great resource potential with nearly a quarter of the world's undiscovered but technically recoverable hydrocarbons, shipping choke points and key shipping strategic routes, and blurred lines of sovereignty that could be a toxic brew.
Borgerson warned that the United States is behind on preparing for the changes caused by melting sea ice.
We are one of the last Arctic coastal nations to take the melting Arctic seriously. And as I'm sure we'll hear from others, the Arctic sea ice is melting far more rapidly than policy is able to keep up with it.
The Oceans Policy Director at the Natural Resources Defense Council, Lisa Speer, says it may be too late to stem the changes in the Arctic, and it's time to figure out how to adapt.
You know, an awful lot of attention is being paid these days to the Arctic as a poster child for the need to deal with CO2 emissions, carbon, et cetera. And very little attention comparatively is paid to how to help this region cope with the incredible changes that are coming.
The panelists say change could affect everything from fisheries management to transportation. The director of the International Polar Year Program Office, David Carlson, predicts culture will change for the people of the North.
A very probable outcome is that the resourceful northern communities will survive and perhaps even thrive, but with substantial changes in their language, their traditions, their cultures, and their social systems.
Carlson says it's likely people around the world will eventually look to northern communities as role models for how to cope with climate change. Both of Alaska's senators spoke at Tuesday's discussion and called for more polar icebreaker ships. Senator Lisa Murkowski pointed out that the U.S. only has two functioning icebreakers, with a third out of commission. Murkowski compared that to Russia, which has 18 and is building three more, the tiny nation of Finland, which has seven, and she said even China, with no Arctic Ocean waters, has one.
If we're seeing a global chess game playing out in the Arctic, then I would suggest that the U.S. is playing with a serious shortage of pieces.
Murkowski says her top priority is to see the United Nations Law of the Sea Treaty ratified by the United States. It sets rights and rules in the world's oceans and guidelines for managing resources. All the roundtable's participants agreed. So did Senator John Kerry. Murkowski, a Republican, and Kerry, a Democrat, encouraged one another to drum up support and interest within their respective parties. The Natural Resources Defense Council's Lisa Speer applauded the discussion, but said it needs to go higher up the political food chain.
Part of the problem is the conversation is happening at the wrong level. We really need leadership. That's the single most important thing. This conversation has to be jacked up about six levels.
Senator Kerry pledged to make the Arctic more of a priority from his seat on the Foreign Relations Committee and said he'll talk with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton about the challenges wrought by climate change in the North. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, diving for trash in Dutch Harbor.
I mean, just about anything, you know, right down to just like your normal trash that you would see on the side of the road. People just throwing things over the side of the sides of their boats.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
Shell Oil is adapting its Beaufort Sea offshore drilling plans to address public concerns about the pace and size it originally proposed. The plan has been the subject of litigation in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Pete Schlaby, Shell's general manager for Alaska, says the company spent a lot of time listening to North Slope residents before cutting its plans in half.
We've had a lot of good cooperation, I think, in putting this together. I think our relationships with the communities has really improved, and their concerns are legitimate, and we need to look at this for the longer term. So, you know, sometimes you need to go slow to go fast, or sometimes you need to go slow to start, and we're clearly willing to do that, and we've taken a lot of good input from the community, and we'll plan on working with them on this.
The new plan for Camden Bay off the Beaufort Sea near the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge calls for drilling two wells with one rig during 1 year of exploration instead of the four wells and two rigs over 3 years originally proposed. Schlaby says while Shell is pulling in its horns on the original plan, That doesn't indicate there were problems with it. He says the company and regulatory agencies have spent millions of dollars reviewing scientific data relating to the project that has been acquired over the past 30 years.
We need to be very clear about what we're doing. We are really doing this and making these adjustments in our plans to address some of the concerns that the stakeholders have expressed. And, you know, the offshore is new, and so we're definitely willing to reach out and have a solution that would work for everybody. But it is based on science, and it's in no way, shape, or form an admission that any of the work that had been done previously was rushed or inadequate. It was adequate.
He says Shell has been getting public feedback on the new exploration plan from stakeholders for the past 3 months and says they have gotten positive responses. The new plan is due to be filed with the Federal Mineral Management Services by the end of the week. Federal officials are again limiting Southeast Alaska charter clients to one halibut per day. Commercial fishermen like the plan, but charter operators expect to challenge it in court. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has details of the rule, which was published today.
The one halibut limit is scheduled to take effect June 5th. The current limit is 2 fish a day. Sue Salveson of NOAA Fisheries says the regional halibut count has dropped as the charter catch has increased. That's why the federal agency issued its rule, which has several provisions.
It's a one fish bag limit for anglers on board charter vessels. The rule also prohibits guides, operators, and crew of a charter vessel from catching and retaining halibut during a charter fishing trip. And the rule also limits the number of lines used to fish for halibut from a charter vessel to 6, or the number of charter anglers on board the vessel, whichever is less.
NOAA Fisheries put a similar limit in place last year. It was dropped after a court challenge by charter operators. Salveson says procedural issues were the problem, and they've been fixed. The one fish a day limit only applies to the regulatory area known as 2C, which covers southeast except Yakutat. It does not affect charters to the north and west in the area known as 3A. Commercial fishermen say the limit is a necessary step to conserve a threatened resource. Sitka's Linda Benkin is executive director of the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association.
The charter fleet has exceeded their allocation for the past 5 years. That has compromised the health of the resource and resulted in lower allocation for the commercial fleet, as well as reduced harvesting opportunities for sport and subsistence. So it's certainly long overdue and an important step in protecting the resource and the interests of all other harvesters.
Charter operators say the limit is based on outdated information. Earl Comstock of the Charter Halibut Task Force says it will unfairly penalize lodge owners and others in the business.
There's been a steady growth in the number of guided anglers, and there's actually been a decline in the number of IFQ holders. So based on the equities of the situation, it seems that a lot of pain is being imposed on one sector of the economy, that the sector that depends on recreational fishing, for the benefit of a very small number of individuals on the commercial sector.
His group sued to block last year's rule. He says that's likely again, with legal action coming within a few weeks. Salveson of NOAA Fisheries says the rule is not a final solution to the guided catch issue. Federal managers are collecting comments on a new limited entry program for charter businesses.
The intent behind that was to establish a universe of charter vessel businesses that then would be better positioned potentially to take the next step towards what is being called a catch share program. And a catch share program primarily is focused on allocating the amount of halibut available for harvest more explicitly between the charter industry and the commercial industry.
The catch share program has not yet gone out for comment. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Dan Sullivan is Anchorage's next mayor. In yesterday's runoff election, the businessman and former Anchorage Assembly member collected approximately 57% of the vote. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The final tally reflected the percentage split that had separated the mayoral candidates throughout much of the evening. A little after 10 p.m., with all Anchorage precincts reporting, Sullivan had nearly 29,000 votes to Eric Croft's, a little over 21,500.
By 9:30, Sullivan was already alternating congratulatory phone calls with reporters' questions at his Millennium Hotel party.
The governor was just calling to congratulate us on a good campaign, and the numbers so far looking as good as they are. And I just see Acting Mayor Matt Klayman just called. Let me call him right back, too, I know he'll want to start talking about transition.
Sullivan will take office on July 1st. Sullivan attributed the victory to his experience in municipal government, especially his 9 years on the Anchorage Assembly before he reached the mandatory term limit.
I think the public, given the tough economic times we're in and, kind of the uncertainty of what happens next in Anchorage, wanted somebody with experience that they felt comfortable taking the reins of city government and wouldn't be learning on the job. And I think I'm that person, and I think they thought so too.
While Croft has spent the last 2 years as a municipal prosecutor, much of his political career was as a multi-term Anchorage representative in the state legislature. At his downtown election night party, Croft watched the early returns and reflected on some of the challenges his campaign had faced.
I think Dan has a name that's very well known. He raised a tremendous amount of money, and he had, to some extent, the field, his side of the aisle, if you will, all to himself for a long time. Those were challenges.
During both the regular and runoff elections, Croft campaigned strongly against a city sales tax. He said, win or lose, he felt some of his other proposals would also impact future municipal politics.
So we think we put ideas out that whoever the next mayor is, they're going to have to address, and I think the people are going to demand some solutions from.
Although Dan Sullivan's father, George, served 14 years as mayor of both the city and then municipality of Anchorage, the younger Sullivan says it was actually his 3 assembly terms that whetted his desire for the city's highest elected office. For KSKA, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communications Systems, serving Alaskans across the state with vital telecommunications since before statehood. ACS, providing voice and high-speed broadband solutions, connects Alaska to the rest of the world. Award-winning news to get you out of bed in the morning. The Alaska Morning News and the Alaska Economic Report bring you the information you need for the day.
Healthcare professionals serving Indigenous populations in several states, as well as Canada and New Zealand, are taking part in the first ever telehealth palliative care symposium being coordinated by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium's Cancer Planning Program. Christine DeCourtney is the ANTHC Cancer Program Manager. She says the virtual discussion taking place over 3 days is bringing together a wide range of international health professionals who are addressing the care requirements of people facing terminal or life-limiting disease. DeCourtney says Indigenous people oftentimes are mixing Western medicine and traditional beliefs.
And it's so important to allow them to practice those beliefs, but support them with Western medicines and care.
Alaska Native Medical Center oncologist Dr. Greg Marino says participants have broached subjects such as accessing long-term care in remote locations and the unique cultural imperatives of treating patients in Native communities. Marino says dealing with stress for the family members of critically ill patients is another concern.
Compassion fatigue and, if you will, provider burnout is huge. And how do we take care of ourselves? And who is there to help take care of us? And how do we take care of each other? That's going to be another important topic that will be covered.
Marino says the proper management of symptoms and pain is a big component of palliative care.
You have to continuously manage the pain medication the way you would manage diabetic medications or hypertensive medications or medications for asthma. You need to continuously manage that. And that's where the training for our students and residents has broken down. They don't really see that. They see the snapshot of the patient, but not the continuum of care.
Marino says simple solutions are often overlooked in favor of new discoveries, such as working with medical students to raise awareness about the cheap and effective drug morphine for severe or chronic pain. He says students often express fear of this old pain medicine when he questions them about its use.
And what's the maximum dose that this patient can take in a 24-hour period? And they get out their iPhones or palms and try to look that up. And I said, there is no maximum dose. The dose is what it is to take care of the pain. And it's that kind of training, that kind of experience that we really need to mainstream for people to get over their fear and anxiety about using these drugs.
Christine DeCourtney says, although pain management is number one, understanding how to take care of mind and spirit is also crucial. She says people often find healing in their family home.
For him to be home, even if it's in a drafty house with not as much care, he gets as much healing from that as someone that might decide they want nice white sheets in a house with people coming in every day to help. You can't measure the importance of people being in familiar surroundings with people they know in other lives and things that are comforting to them as a true medicine that can make people that are nearing the end of life or have a chronic illness feel better.
The symposium wraps up tomorrow. Resources and all discussion materials will be online. You can find the link at our website, aprn.org. Each year, Unalaskans participate in the community-wide cleanup, but some take the project to a deeper level. KUCB's Ann Hillman joined the Unalaska Divers Association as they cleaned beneath the surface.
A group of 8 volunteer divers, including Aura Beatty, swim around the sea float in the small boat harbor, collecting debris.
We found 2 large crab pots, but they were deeply, deeply embedded and wouldn't come up. We found everything from like old PVC piping to strange wooden objects that looked like plows. It was just about anything, you know, right down to just like your normal trash that you would see on the side of the road. But people just throwing things over the sides of their boats.
With help from UNICE employees, they pull up bulky objects covered in sea anemones, urchins, sponges, starfish, and other sea life. The dock reeks from the rotting mud that drips off the trash, and, as Chris Graves explains, from some of the casualties. Birds get caught in the abandoned crab pots at the bottom of the harbor.
The birds can't find a way out. They think there's food in there, they'll see something to go after, but once they get in there, there's no way back out of it, so they drowned.
But the team tries to save what they can, and they toss starfish, crabs, and other animals back into the water. This is the 2nd year they've cleaned up the small boat harbor. Last year, they couldn't get it all. Jennifer Shockley says it isn't easy.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a lot of work. When you start diving and you add in the fact that you're trying to, you know, see invisibility, you know, you've only got about 6-inch to 1-foot visibility, and you're trying to tie stuff off and do fancy knots underwater with big, thick mittens on your hand. And yeah, it's a lot of work, but it's fun.
The divers tie buoys to some of the objects, and UNICE workers help hoist them out.
Come on, mussels!
It's a big one. It's like a 6-foot one.
Okay. Others are raised to the surface with lift bags. The divers tie empty bags to the trash, then blow air into them until they float closer to the surface. All of the waste, including almost a dozen crab pots and a car battery, is taken to the landfill for proper disposal. I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by STEMS, where thoughts are sent with flowers and gifts can be blooming with color and aroma. STEMS in Anchorage at 907-563-3366. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.